Tom Higg loves adventure. He was a high-flying diver in his youth and had wild travels around the world. A bicycling accident left him paralyzed from the waist down in 1996. It was a tough path back, but Higg keeps on moving. Welcome to Viewscapes, stories from Washington State Magazine, connecting you to Washington State University, the state, and the world. I'm Larry Clark, editor of the magazine. Tom chronicles his life, struggles, and triumphs in a new memoir from WSU Press, Global Nomad, My Travels Through Diving, Tragedy, and Rebirth. He writes with wit and candor about the ups and downs of adventure and trials, culminating in his new career as a documentary filmmaker. I had the chance to talk with Tom about reinventing his life, going to WSU, and writing his book.
I am Tom Higg, a 2010 graduate of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication in broadcast journalism, where I was a student of Glenn Johnson, among others.
And you have recently released your memoir, Global Nomad, and I was pretty excited to get a copy and to start reading it and learning a little bit more about you. So I'm excited to let our listeners know about the book and about your really fascinating story.
Well, it's almost like three books in one, because I have had that kind of a life. My first half of my life up until I was 30, I was a springboard and tower diver all through high school, college, and then eventually was picked up by a professional diving outfit, and we would do extreme dives. So all the way up to like 94 feet, multiple somersaulting dives. And we'd also do clown shows and light ourselves on fire and do all these, you know, tricks and stuff. Really interesting way to live. And that's first 7 years out of college. That's what I did. Ended up moving to Portland, Oregon. I started working for Adidas. And while I was there, I was also a bike rider. So I stopped training as a diver because I didn't need to train as a diver anymore. I was probably as good as I was going to get. And I fell in love with cycling. I dove into it as hard as I could and ended up getting in a bike wreck, hit a truck, and this is in 1996, September of 1996, and have been paralyzed from the waist down ever since. I don't know if you ever recover from this, because your life is permanently changed, but it's about having, you know, just the depths of depression and what do you do to get out of that? And then also another big part of this book is my brother is Dr. Andy Higg, who at the time was the director of the University of Michigan Spine Center. So he was a global medical doctor, global expert in spinal cord injury, which is very serendipitous. I would have rather he did something else. But since that time, we've gotten together. We started a nonprofit called the International Rehabilitation Forum, and we collect, it's a consortium of doctors who live in some of the poorest countries on earth and practice rehab medicine. And so we've gathered these guys together, women as well, for medical conferences. And eventually these doctors were like, we need you to come to our clinic. We really, you know, they've got a bunch of spinal cord patients, other disabilities. And they like, we need someone like you to come and just hang with our patients, basically be a peer counselor. And I was like, I'll come. But I was like, I don't want to be a peer clown. I want to work. And so I picked up my skill set that I learned at Wazoo as a video producer, as a documentary producer, brought my cameras over, ended up spending months and months. I didn't just go there for like a week, but spending months and months in some of these disability enclaves, shooting their stories, shooting how the hospital works, and then eventually teaching kids with disability how to shoot and edit video themselves.
What are some of the countries that you did this work in?
So the first half, the diving countries, was all over the place, mostly in Northern Europe. I was in Taiwan, did a stint in the Middle East in the United Arab Emirates. But most of that time, actually, I spent the last 7 years I did this. I spent the last 3.5-4 years in France, and I moved into I was the show captain at this park called Avenir Land, which means future land, which is funny because it was an old West theme park. just one of those language things you meet when you cross. This is when I started becoming a bike rider, and I became just engrossed in the Tour de France, and they ride the Tour de France over the roads I was training on. So I just became a bikeaholic. So I spent biggest chunk of my time living in France, Traveling with the International Rehabilitation Forum, I did a big chunk in Albania, went to Ghana for 5 weeks, and then I spent 4.5 months in Nepal. And I was about to spend 6 months in Senegal, spent the first 4 months there, and then COVID hit, and we had to get evac'd out, even though there was almost no COVID in Senegal. We only had like a dozen cases in the whole country and none in Dakar, where I was living. They shut down the airport, and I had to hop an embassy charter off to D.C., even though literally there was almost no COVID there. But
well, as the pandemic is shifting, are you hoping to do this in the future and continue the work?
Yeah, I really would like to. Right now I work for the Portland Bureau of Transportation, because when I got back, I mean, it was COVID. I'd spent all my it took a long time to raise money for these trips, and it took me 2 years to raise money for the Senegal trip. And people donating equipment, cameras and computers and tripods, you know, for these schools. And I left all the stuff over there, and we weren't quite through with the whole project. There was still a lot of stuff we wanted to do, but I had to go home. And trying to raise money during the pandemic was impossible. The donor fatigue was 100%. And people were afraid, right? I mean, people were dying. People were, you know, losing their houses and all this stuff. So it was impossible to raise money during the pandemic. So I started working with the Portland Bureau of Transportation. I work in events group here, which has been really great. I've got a couple of contracts. At the end of this contract, I'm going to concentrate on getting back to what I do, which is working with kids with disability.
You know, you have this great interest in travel. The book talks about your travels, you know, when you're doing the diving. And I was kind of wondering, you know, after the accident, did you feel like that part of your life became limited, or that you wouldn't be able to travel anymore?
I was petrified that it was. I was petrified. And this is amazing. My French mom, so a family adopted me when I lived in France, and they just took care of me and a couple of other divers on our team. Like, they'd do our laundry. They'd have us over for dinner. And like, my French mom would be like, looked disapprovingly upon a girlfriend I was going out with. You know, she totally adopted me as a mom. And the word got out that I broke my back, and she called me and she was like, you have to come back to France. And I was in the hospital bed when she called, and I'm like, I am really messed up, Janine. I don't think I can come. And she's like, I'll call you in a month. So in a month she calls me back. And I was like, yeah. And I started going back to school and went back to take some classes. And I was like, yeah, I think I can. I've got some time between my spring semester and summer. I can probably come for a couple of weeks. And she was having none of that. She was like, you are coming all summer long, and you're staying with us all summer long. And I was like, I think I can do that. And we're living in the foothills of the Alps, one of the most beautiful places you could ever live. A bunch of people from my high school swim team, my college swim team, and my coworkers from Adidas raised a bunch of money and bought me a hand cycle, competitive hand cycle. So I put it in a box, shipped it over to France with me, and started getting out and slowly riding my old rides, the old training rides I have, which are tough. I mean, these are... it's the Alps, right? And it's a hand cycle. So it took me so much longer to get up these climbs. And it was really difficult. But then finally, one day, I got to the top of one of the big climbs around my neighborhood and started shooting down the backside of the mountain. And for the first time since I broke my back, I was screaming for joy. I was like, this is awesome. This is amazing. And it was really the turning point where I was like, I think there's a future here. I don't feel like killing myself every day. I just experienced something that was as profound as anything I had through the rest of my life from my former life. I was like, wow, if there's still opportunities like this, I've got to go search for those opportunities. And so that put the travel bug back in me. And by the end of that trip, I actually went to Israel and Egypt for for 2 weeks just to prove I could go travel by myself. They're not really super difficult countries, but they're not Europe either. So, you know, a challenging country. Egypt, obviously more challenging than Israel, but just wanted to see if I could do it by myself. And had just amazing couple, 3 weeks in Israel and Egypt, and came back to America just really, really feeling energized by the whole experience.
That idea of kind of just going for it, really, it struck me in what you called your Bridge to Venice rule.
Yeah.
You know, can you talk a little bit about that and how that came to be and what it means?
That was the original title of the book, was The Bridge to Venice. And what it was my very first trip to Europe. I was with my brother, Dan. And it's really funny. I left America for a month in Europe, and I brought $300 with me. And this is 1986. We kind of knew how much stuff cost because my brother had been living over there, but we needed more than $300. We got to our last week. We had no money left. We had no money. We had like a half a tank of gas in the car, and we were in the Italian city of Trier, which is right on the Slovenian-Croatian border. Then it was Yugoslavia. And we had 4 or 5 days to kill before we had a friend of mine who was going to send me a paycheck from home. He was going to wire it to me, American Express, but it wasn't going to get there for 4 or 5 days. And we're like, well, we can sit here in Trier, or we can like blow our tank of gas. So we went into Yugoslavia and drove around, and we had no money for food. We had half a bottle of rum. We had some chocolate, you know, but we had no food. And I remember one time we had like enough money to buy some apples. And my brother goes into a bodega and picks some apples. And we looked so like just emaciated that the owner of the bodega started throwing stuff into our bag. She was like, you boys look awful. And so we looked really, really bad. And we got to Venice with 1 day left. And now we had like enough gas to get to Verona, where the paycheck was coming in. You know, we're sitting on the edge of Venice. It's a 3-mile bridge to get from the port, which is Mestre, to Venice. We're like, oh my God, it's going to be a 3-mile walk. We're going to walk around all day and 3 miles back, and we have no food, no money. And we're like, most people would just like hang out in the car and just be like, we're good. We just traveled all around Europe. But we're like, no, that's not what we do. So we did. We walked across the bridge. We walked all around Venice all day on empty stuff. We hadn't eaten a meal in like 4 or 5 days. Mm. Like, this is the kind of stuff we decided to do. We decided we're going to push ourselves to the extreme. And if the choice is do what's sedate or do what you don't know, you got to go and do what you don't know, no matter what. And we had this on the way back to the car, you know, we were on the bridge to Venice, and you know, silhouette of Venice going behind us with golden sunset. And we had this massive epiphany where we're like, this is what we've decided to do. This is what we're going to do the rest of our lives, is make these kinds of decisions. And we have 40 years later, and we have made those kinds of decisions at every turn.
And that rule, did it help you then after the accident?
At that time, it was almost mechanical memory or mechanical motor memory, where it's just like, you have to do this. And I knew it was going to be really tough. The other thing is, like, I didn't have to go to Europe to push myself. It was incredibly difficult in the beginning every day just to sit up, just to get in my bed or get in my wheelchair, you know, just pain all the time. So it didn't take, you know, any extravagant situation for those kind of that mentality to hop in. I had to do that mentality every single day, and I didn't succeed. I mean, there were days where I just was like, I can't do it. This is just too much. And then you have to go back down, recollect yourself, wait, chill out, patience, start up the next day. And, you know, eventually, you know, it took forever, but, you know, work my way through it. So I eventually would wake up feeling good in the morning. And that probably took at least 5 or 6 years before I actually would wake up on a daily basis not feeling awful.
Mm. And when did you start doing the work around the world with disability communities and the education work that you've done?
So this is really great. Our nonprofit, we hosted a medical conference in the city of Kayseri, which is in the middle of Turkey. So Cappadocia is the city. It's near Cappadocia is a big tourist place with these beautiful rock formations. It's funny, the town Kayseri, it comes from the Latin Gaius Julius Caesari, so it means Caesar. And it's one of the oldest cities in Turkey. It hosts the oldest university on earth, and that's where it's called Ucyrus University, and that's where we held our conference. And we had 80 doctors from all over the world, physical physiatrists, they're called, rehab doctors, physical medicine doctors, and they all came and everyone presented papers. And we did some team building exercises. There was really this amazing synergy among these 80 doctors. And that's when I met these doctors that were like, we need you to come to my clinic. We need you to come sit with my patients and tell them that there's life after spinal cord injury. And that was the foundation for the trips that I took, that I was actually going to clinics where these doctors held, did their practice. And these were, I mean, it's like, you know, an Italian doctor working in Albania and a Swiss doctor working in Ghana. And that Nepalese guy we met at another conference. A couple of years later, we had a conference in Bangladesh and we ran into the only Nepalese physiatrist, and he's in a chair himself. He's a guitar player. I'm a guitar player. And we hit it off right away. And it just like, we became like blood brothers right away. And Nepal had a big earthquake in 2015. And he was like, you have to come to my clinic. And I was like, absolutely. So I had to wait for a couple of months because a clinic that had 40 beds, they had 100 new spinal cord patients in one day. So they had to set up triage tents in their parking lot. And they got these tents from like the Pakistani army. We got to see who survives first and, you know, who's okay. They're going to survive without immediate care. And this went on for about 4 months. And after 4 months, he was like, yeah, it's ready. We're ready for you to come. And that's when I went over there with my cameras and tripods and microphones. And we ended up shooting 30 videos on things from like physical therapy, occupational therapy, nursing, disability awareness. We got involved with the sports groups. So we shot one. There's a Kathmandu wheelchair basketball league, not just a team, but a league. They've got 8 men's teams and 3 women's teams in the city of Kathmandu. So shot something on that, and just shot something on the Nepalese disabled table tennis society. It's one of the most popular sports is table tennis. And so they've got this massive table tennis facility that crushed in the earthquake, and they rebuilt it. And we did a video for the opening. And it was amazing because I had a bunch of old stills of the building being crushed. And then I had pictures of them working on it. And then for the big finale, I had pictures of just the day before the opening when they're painting and, you know, the place was completely built. And the video, so the short video, 2 minutes, but I switched from black and white. I did like a Wizard of Oz thing, switched from black and white. The music was like traditional Nepalese. And then I went right to hardcore rock and roll, and everything's in color. It just exploded in color. And the audience, must have been 200, 250 people there, exploded. They exploded as if they'd just seen a goal scored in the World Cup. As a filmmaker, that never happens to you. You don't go see your film. People might go polite applause, but this was absolutely explosion of joy. And I looked at my buddy who's an architect, and we just had like tears coming down our eyes. We're like, we were not expecting that reaction. You know, so you find these gems. They do happen if you go out there and make an effort.
That's wonderful. So, you know, kind of you're talking about the videos that you were making. It's been on my mind. How did you end up going to WSU? Why did you pick Washington State?
That's a great story too. What it was I was a freelance web and web print and copywriter. I did this for about 7 years and I was barely paying rent. And my dad talked to me one day and he's like, is this what you want to do the rest of your life? And I was like, no. I was like, I want to go back and be a journalist. Pardon me. Prior to that, I had worked on the Adidas paper. I was the Adidas corporate writer. And I was like, I want to go back and do that. I want to go back and become a journalist. And he was like, let's do it. And I was like, it's college. It's really expensive. He goes, I don't care. You look for the school. I'll find the money. I went out that night with a friend of mine, went to watch a college football game at the sports bar, and I'm talking to my friend, and some guy overhears me. He was a basketball player for the Cougs. He'd been out of college for about 15 years, and he was like, dude, because I was talking, where do I go? Go to Oregon, because they've got this journalism program, and I heard about the Cronkite School down at Arizona State, and I figured the Bay Area or UCLA, you know, but they're super expensive, whatever. And he goes, dude, you need to go to the Murrow College at Washington State, which I had never heard of. And he's like, yeah, it's Edward R. Murrow. Keith Jackson came out of this school and stuff. And we had a laptop. So I looked at it and I was like, get out. And he goes, yeah, it's the best broadcast school anywhere in the Pac-12. And he's, if not top five in the country. And I just was like, Washington State and Pullman. I had to look on the map to see where Pullman was. And I was like, how is that a broadcasting place above UCLA? Yeah, I started looking into it and it was like, no, Wazoo is the place. They have the best broadcasting thing in the Pac-12. And so I applied. I got accepted to a grad program. And then when I finally showed up on campus, it was like, it was a graduate school in communications and they're studying like phonemes and morphemes. I was like, I don't want to do that. I want to go on TV. So I dropped out of the grad program and went in for the second undergrad program in broadcasting. I also started looking for financing and I found a group out of USC. They're called Swim with Mike. And they have this massive endowment that they've built over the last 35 years. They had a swimmer at USC named Mike Nyholt, who broke his back, and they started raising money so he could stay on a scholarship, and it went overboard. Now they've got this massive endowment and they give full scholarships to athletes with disability. And I applied for it and they gave me a full scholarship. It just, these pieces started falling into place. I had a full scholarship, moved to Pullman in the middle of winter, which I was crazy because it snowed like 2 feet the day before. And I'm like, there's no way I can get around this campus, and figured out how that worked. And then, met Glenn Johnson and I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get through this. And then Glenn kind of took me under his wing and, you know, shepherded me through this process and met these amazing professors like Leroy Ashby, who is Washington State Professor of the Year, and Dave Jarvis, who just really became like this guy in my corner and stuff. And I didn't get good grades at the University of Illinois, but Pullman, man, I graduated cum laude from Pullman just because I was so entertained. I was entertained all the time.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And all those professors you're talking about, you know, they're brilliant. Yeah. I heard Dave Jarvis last year playing here in town.
We jammed together. We jammed together over at Rico's. We did a 2-minute piece, and it started out with me outside doing the stand up, and then went inside and with the Jarvis. What was it? Jarvis Dozier
Quartet, was it?
Quartet. Yeah. So yep. I sat in with them. We played the Steve Martin tune. Oh my God, where he's dancing with the Sphinx. King Tut.
Oh yeah, King Tut. King yeah. Tut.
at Rico's, and we use it as part of the piece. It's a great piece.
I'm pretty sure plenty of our alumni that are listening have pretty fond memories of listening to music at Rico's. I know I do.
Oh, absolutely. It was one of my favorite things in Pullman.
Yeah, and it's great to hear that you were able to take those skills and everything you learned, you know, at WSU and use it to make these films. Do you still do that kind of work?
When I can, actually, for the city of Portland, we do documentary, or not documentaries, we do training films. So I do get to use, not as much as I'd like here, but that's one of my gigs here, is I produce videos for bike events and things like that.
So I was going to ask you about the book. How did that come about? Did you always have in mind that you'd like to write a memoir, or did somebody inspire you to do it?
Yeah, I always did. And what it was when I first got my diving job, I was always a writer. I did much better in writing classes than anything else. And then when I got my first diving job, or actually my first trip, this trip to Europe when we got stuck in Yugoslavia, I became like an avid journalist or journal writer. Especially when I started diving, I realized my friends were all going to grad school. They were starting their first jobs. They were doing internships. Some of them went out to Colorado to be ski bums and stuff like that. And I was jumping off of things and getting paid for it. So I'm like, this is an odd way to make a living. And having these great adventures, meeting people that did this and traveling in between the shows, traveling around Europe. So I started just journaling. I didn't just write down notes. I would write them down in full-length stories, assuming that I would take these journals and turn them into a book at some point. God, I ended up having about 2,000 pages of journals throughout the diving episode, whatever. And then I got it home and I put it together into some kind of book form. And I wanted to sell that book and I couldn't get a buyer for that. And after I broke my back, I moved to India. Here's another funny thing. My other brother, Dan, was the webmaster for the Dalai Lama and worked in the first Tibetan computer resource lab. Wow. So I actually quit my job at Adidas before my job was drying up, but I quit and moved over to Dharamsala, India. That's when I really started putting together the whole book. And I probably sat there for 5 to 6 hours a day for 3 to 4 months and just wrote. It's funny, I didn't have my journals with me. My journals were all in the States, but this is when I had the time. This is when I was like, you don't have time like this in your life. This was precious time. And so I just started writing and I just dove in and wrote the whole thing from memory. And then I'd take notes and when I came back home, I'd fill in blocks that I didn't have. But I wrote the whole thing from memory and it ended up being about 600 pages, which I knew it was therapy. I mean, who are you kidding? It was therapy. I needed to rediscover who I was as someone in a wheelchair. And this really was helping me. And there were periods like I'd write about the accident and I was crying, had to put it down for like a day or two and then go back to it. And it was really tough getting through that part. Ended up with a good chunk of book. And I started pushing that when I got home. And there I found an agent and she believed in it. She wanted it to go, but she couldn't find anyone to take on the project. And she was like, the problem is you're not famous. So I'm like, ugh. So ended up, at that point, getting heavily involved with the International Rehabilitation Forum and going on these trips and spending, 4 or 5 months at a time, again, living in these countries. And I started writing again and filling in. Every time I'd come home from a trip, I'd write up that, put it back in, had to throw out something from the old book. Eventually, after this last trip to Senegal, wrote up the whole Senegal. And that ended up in a really great, crazy adventure, getting on the embassy flight home, chopped it down to the palatable 330 pages or whatever it is, and submitted it first to the University of Illinois, University of Illinois Press. And they were like, we don't do books like that. And then I submitted it to Wazoo, and Linda Bathgate picked up the book. She liked it. And she was like, this is exactly what we're looking for. We're looking for faculty and student memoirs, and we're going to launch a new subsidiary called Basalt Books. And this is exactly what we're looking for. And I could not believe the email when I'm reading this. I'm like, wait, you didn't say you're going to do it. And then I was like, so you're going to actually publish this thing? And she's like, absolutely. And I was floored because it literally had been 38, 39 years from conception to the fact where someone bought into the project. And God, if Washington State isn't like the land of opportunity, I just don't know what is. And it's, I mean, yeah, people like, I didn't get into UW, so I got to go to Wazoo. Screw that, man. Wazoo is the land of opportunity. If you take advantage of what's available to you in Pullman, you can't fail. I mean, there's just so much talent in the faculty and the attitude of the students and just very career-driven people at Wazoo, and just love the place to pieces.
Yeah, and I'm so excited it worked out. The timing was perfect. For our listeners, Linda Bathgate is the excellent editor of WSU Press, and Basalt Books had just basically been launched, right? It was like this new imprint they were doing.
I think it's the third one, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Because I remember talking to Linda a couple of years ago about Basalt Books, and this was exactly what her vision was. This telling these stories of WSU alumni and people around the state, compelling stories. And I have to say, looking at the book, I could tell, you took amazing notes and wrote journals. The storytelling and the details throughout the book are really gripping. So I know when readers pick up this book, and hopefully a lot of them will, this is some excellent reading.
And I wish I could claim that that's all my genius, but I had two amazing editors as well. And they are my sister, Barb, who's a professional PR consultant and actually works for Johnson Controls. But she's editor extraordinaire. Also, my brother, Dan, who works for a company called Intellix that takes old English and French manuscripts and puts them up online for libraries to sell. Pretty crazy. They would be like, you need to flesh this out more, because I knew all these people, right? And I had these ideas in my head, and they're like, and there were lots of exercises like this, along with like me missing commas and, the regular editing stuff like that. From what I gather, people get through the book, which is, it's kind of an egotistical thing to ask someone, here, go take 10 hours of your life and spend it on me. And so hopefully they're getting the payoff and they're not wasting their time. And early reviews are that it's readable. People do get through it. They don't get like, oh, this is muckety muck stuff. They actually are getting through it. So I'm pretty happy the way it turned out.
For people who are going to read this book, what do you want them to learn from it?
First off, I hope they get a laugh out of it. I mean, that's, you know, that was the original intent of starting to writing, is that it was a really crazy way to live and there were crazy adventures involved with this. So I hope they get like a drop jawed kind of like laugh at the first part. And the second part, it's like, once you experience something like that, you got to find it again. You got to find those laughs. You got to find those experiences. And the only way you do it is, like I say, just dive in. You got to just go after it. And God, it's like, that sounds like, oh, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And for me, it was not that easy. And I was depressed for a very long, severely depressed. And people talk about suicidal ideation. I was beyond that. I had a plan. I was ready to off myself. And I had to check myself. I had a really great psychiatrist at my rehab. It was a Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago, which is actually where my brother did his internship. And a psychiatrist there gave me this clue or a great trick. And she said, when you get depressed, as far as you have, where you're down suicidal, the next time anything bad happens, you're not going to get just a little depressed. You're going to go right down to that basement. You are going to be in the basement for anything. You will burn your omelet. You will miss a bus. You will do anything that is slightly disturbing. Instead of being slightly disturbed, boom, you're going to right down to that basement. And she's like, you have to realize that. And you have to be able to pull yourself out of that situation, evaluate what really happened here. Is this something I can fix right now? How do I fix it? And try to keep yourself out of that basement. Because there really only one thing to put you in the basement. It's breaking your back. Everything else is not going to be that bad. But at the time, I couldn't see that. I could not see that. So it took a long time. So, I mean, if you read through the book, you know, you get through it in a couple of hours. You're like, oh, you got through that really great. It's like, no, it took a long time. And it was not easy. And I had to ask for help. And I had to be willing to accept the help that people were giving me, which is not something I was used to doing before. I really had before. I was like, I do whatever I want. I'm diving and getting paid for it. And this is a great life. And now I had to ask people for help and be willing to accept it. So I hope people can get that from the book. I mean, just think of those first couple of months of the pandemic. We're like, what is this? When does it ever end? My mother died in the first month of the pandemic, and we couldn't have anyone come to her funeral. You couldn't have more than 7 people in a gathering at that point. My mother's incredibly social woman. You know, things like this would just drop you. And we all experienced it together, which is, you know, just extraordinary. And I hope, I don't think people have gotten over that yet. I think it's going to, there's going to be a long lasting effect, because now everyone's like, oh, that was 2 years. I'm just going to forget. It's like, it's not good to forget stuff like that.
And I think your book offers some really good insight and some, hopefully, you know, people can really get that lesson from it. And where can people find out all this information about the book tour, things that you're up to?
Easy as can be. Go to WSU Press, Google WSU Press, and put Global Nomad in the search bar, and all the information pops out.
Perfect.
Good news is we can buy the book. Bad news is we sold out in the first run. So it might be a little step before books end up at your doorstep.
Hey, thanks for joining me today. Any last words for Cougar Nation listeners to the podcast?
Yeah, just if you're feeling down, go look for some help. And if you're having a good time, ride it. And go Cougs. Go Cougs all day.
Thanks for listening to Viewscapes. You can read a review of Tom's memoir in the summer 2023 issue of Washington State Magazine at magazine.wsu.edu. Our music was by WSU Emeritus Professor Greg Yasinitsky.